Welcome to the continued podcast adventures of three opinionated guys with mics and too much free time. Strong enough to stop a speeding movie rumor, more powerful than a bad comic book event. Able to waste hours of time asking stupid questions to people who have better things to do. It's Dave, Ben, and John. It's Superhero Speak.
Did they know that you moonlight as a superhero?
The funny thing is, my son thinks Manta Maji is equal to Superman. And the best story I have is I took him to the mall. And he was playing with some kid in a little mall, a little parking thing. And he's like, let's play superheroes. And he's like, I'll be Superman. You be Manta Maji. And the kid looked at him like, what? So he thinks cool. Manta Maji is equal to all the others. And then I have the statue from the live action short. We have like a sitting in my office and the face job looks so real that he just stares at it all the time and thinks it's a real person. Funny.
Nice. Yeah.
Cool. So, I like that story, so I'm not going to cut it out. So,
right. When do we ever want to cut out anything in the beginning?
No, we don't. So anyway, so those who haven't figured it out yet, you're listening to Superhero Speak, and I'm your host, Dave.
And John.
And we have returning, technically, this week. He is not only a talented television director, he is also an independent comic book creator. He has created the legend of the Manta Maji. See, I said it right.
You did.
And, of course, it's Eric Dean Seton. How are you doing, sir?
I'm doing wonderful. How are you guys doing?
Good.
We're doing good. It was good. a little wet yesterday, but the sun came out today.
Wait. Where are you guys?
Wait, John, what is that?
Oh, that is literally a plane outside my window.
Oh, okay.
We aim for authenticity here at Superhero Speak. So, I'm not taking a plane somewhere.
Oh, okay. We're in Philly. So, yeah, it was a rainy day yesterday.
I'm in L.A., so it's just we have windy, so we're about to get El Nino or whichever one it is. It's very, 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 very windy.
Oh, okay.
But yeah, are you getting rain? Yeah. That's the big question.
Not yet. I think it's probably coming, but right now, no rain. So that's not bad. That's not
too bad. Hopefully soon.
Yes.
Yeah. Now we could use it.
Yeah.
So were you, that's a good way to lead into our first question. Were you born and raised in California?
No, I am born and raised in Cleveland, Ohio. I am a Buckeye through and through. I went to Ohio State. So I'm everything that is Ohio and everything that makes you want to get out of Ohio.
Nice.
So you missed the snow?
Pardon me? Do I miss the...
The snow.
I can hear you.
I'm sorry. Do you miss the snow?
No, I don't. You know what I miss? I miss the snow during the holiday season because you go outside. The seasons don't change here. You know, there's no fall. I mean, the leaves are falling right now, but it's not much, you know. And then Christmas and Hanukkah, whatever you celebrate, comes around that time, and then it's over, and the weather never changes. So I miss the weather. I don't miss being in the cold, though.
No. Yeah, I've lived in Houston, and I've worked in Las Vegas. And so those people who live with the seasons and then go over to a place where there aren't, it's kind of hard sometimes. So we have a friend actually who moved, who we used to work with, Dave and I used to work with, who lives over San Francisco way, working for Pandora, and she really misses the seasons.
Yeah, I can imagine. I'm taking my son to Cleveland with me next week, so maybe if it's snowy, he'll get to see what that's like. But I like that on December 31st, if I need to run out and grab something, I can, and there's no change in the weather. But you just feel a hollow feeling like during the holidays. There's nothing to like. It's over. Like it's just another day. You know what I mean?
Yeah. There's nothing to indicate. And right. For your son, no snow days.
No snow days. And I growing up, I missed like weeks of school and stuff before. no snow days at all. So that's a little weird.
so not to talk about weather the whole show. So was directing something you always wanted to do, and I assume that's why you moved out to California?
Yeah, it's weird. I I grew up loving storytelling. I loved, all movies and TV shows. And I was a weird kid. Like, I would stay and watch the credits and movies and TV shows, and I always knew all these names and TV shows and every theme song. But it's going to sound weird, but it's a little different now because people have, phones on cameras on their phones. But mm-hmm. I just didn't think you could become a director, and I didn't know how to become a director. And it's weird. Like, right before I went to college, I wrote a letter to, of all people, Bill Cosby, saying that there were saying, look, I may think I'm funny, but I don't want to be a comedian. But you work with directors, and I would like to meet some directors. Like, could you, give me some ideas or recommendations on that? And I mailed a letter to his agents. I didn't even know they did the Cosby Show in New York. I mailed it to his agents in California. And I guess the way it was written, the agent felt sorry for me and gave it to him. And I ended up doing an internship on the Cosby Show, on the last season of the Cosby Show. So I was exposed to, like, everything television, directors, some of the top directors, all this stuff. Like, and the weird thing was that kind of changed my whole perspective on, like, going after your dreams. And now I can't be more of a proponent than anybody. I always tell them, do whatever it is that's going to make you happy, even if it sounds like even if you have no idea how to do it or no idea into it, because 9 times out of 10, if you do what makes you happy, you're going to succeed and you're going to be happy and have a great life.
Hmm. And just so our listeners know, the reason why Dave is asking this is because I am looking at YouTube right now with the Legend of Mantamaggi live short action movie. And yep. I am really impressed. It's like, it's got a Witchblade Blue Beetle feel with a mantis twist.
I think you got it right. It's funny because when I made the books and even the short, like, there's no, like, set reference of anything I grew up on. But in writing the story, I think it's just, I always call it like a soup, and I poured everything that I ever liked into the story. And so probably when you make a reference like that, you're probably 100% right. It's just not like something I actually said, oh, I love this in Mantis, or I love this in Blue Beetle, I'm going to add that. It's just like, I guess the epitome of things that just came out of, like, all the things I ever liked growing up, I put into it,
Well, and so. It's really cool because there's, like, I mean, it raises a lot of questions. Like, there seems to be a lot of backstory, and, I can't wait to see more, which is really good. I mean, you see a lot of these YouTube one-offs, or, guys like us trying to do something like this. And it's hard to get everything together just right, especially doing action scenes. But this is one of the few times where I've been watching one, and, like, I get to the end, I'm like, wow, that was awesome. Nothing came to mind because I'm a curmudgeon. Okay. Right. I'm old. I'm a curmudgeon. I'm supposed to pick on people, but it was really good. It was as good as some of the stuff you're seeing on TV.
Oh, thank you. That means, the funny thing is, you don't know how much that actually means. It really, like, people always say that stuff, but I'm honest when I was like, that means so much, because you really, it's funny because I'm a working director. So I think I bring what I'm going to say right now is a little bit different than what people know, but a different perspective. But, like, I do all these shows, but at the end of the day, you don't own it. You're just trying to do the best job you can. It's not yours per se. You try to make it yours for the moment. But when it's actually something that's yours, and then, someone like you likes it or has that kind of comment, it means so much, because it's like, it's the first thing of all the stuff I've done. It's the first thing that's, like, really mine. You know what I mean? Like, there's no paycheck behind it. It's true passion, and it's true, like, my idea and all that type of stuff. So it actually really means a lot, because anytime anybody's ever does something like that, there is a big gamble. Like, you never really know. You're just putting out what you think is cool, what you think people would like, and also what you like, because you can't please everybody. And then, so when you get a great response, it really rings true,
Yeah. And what you're saying too, about not consciously picking, Blue Beetle or Mantis, just things that you like, from when you were a kid, putting it in the story. I mean, I definitely can relate to that, in a former life, not so much anymore. I was a musician and a songwriter. Start writing a song, and somebody goes, oh, wow, but that kind of sounds like Led Zeppelin, or, oh, that kind of sounds like Pearl Jam. And it's like, I wasn't consciously trying to sound like them. It's just, it's, you know, that's the stuff I like. So it gets mixed into there a little bit, you know?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So yeah, definitely. Like, and that's, I learned, you know, and I'm sure you can attest to this. You don't worry about that, you know, when somebody, you know, you take it more of a compliment than saying, oh, you're trying to rip it off, you know?
Oh, that's, Yeah. You know the dude. Here's the thing. In your heart of hearts, you know if you're trying to rip something off or if you're just trying to, if you're just influenced by stuff. But we're all influenced by something. You know what I mean? Like nothing is, either somebody motivates us or something that we've seen that we like, or even if we just say, hey, I want to do something exact opposite of that, we're still motivated by some sort of thing. You know what I mean? I mean, we're literally all the Star Wars generation, you know, where we all, you know, somehow, some way we're influenced by Star Wars, you know, or something in Star Wars or,
right,
or any of those movies of that time, you know, even if it's like Godfather or something, we're all like, yeah, you know, every director, artist, everybody's always said they liked somebody before them, you know, and somebody before them did something cool.
Mm-hmm. Right. So actually you brought up an interesting point earlier and I was always kind of curious about this, like, you know, with a movie or a short or whatever, you know, the director has his vision and he has, you know, a lot of control over what happens and whatnot. But I imagine TV's a lot different, right? Because you're coming into a show that's established a lot of times and you're just doing one episode or two episodes and then you're going to move on to another project. Like, how does it work in television with directing?
It is. Well, first of all, TV is a writer's medium. If you really want to be a writer that has power, write for television. And the reason being is because they have to produce 22 episodes. So a movie is one time thing. Director's in charge because it's one vision, one thing, one movie. They're going to make it for a year and then it's going to take a year and then it's going to come out. But TV, they got to make 22, 23, 25, 13 episodes. So the writers have to be in charge because they're working on those scripts for, you know, 2 months. Each script is pretty much worked on, except for towards the end of the season, for like almost 2 months, like 6 to 8 weeks, you know, so they know the overall arc and all that. And so rightfully so, they should be in charge. And so as a television director, you kind of come in, you know, there's a tone of the show. Now, it's weird because if you do the pilot, you set the tone of the show. So the pilot director is 100% influential in that show. And then for the most part, there's a tone that's set by the second episode. Whether that be the pilot director or that be the main director that comes in next, who's a lot of times director producer, they set the tone, and the look is established. And so you do have to maintain. You do get to be you. You do get to be extremely creative, and you do. And here's the thing: you know, they could hire anybody, or not anybody, but they could hire a lot of different people. So you do have to leave a mark, as well as not rock the boat at the same time. So you have to add something. And this example I can give you is there's a director, Glenn Winter, who did the pilot to Smallville, and he was the D on Arrow and directed and Smallville and Flash and now he did the pilot to Legends of Tomorrow. Well, he didn't direct till episode 18 of the first season of Arrow, but what he did in that episode set the tone for the rest of the series because he did dissolves and great transitions with the flashbacks. And he gave it a real style and a great look. And it, you know, it pretty much changed his career because he got to do, Supergirl and going from the CW to, CBS to get a pilot is, the producers really have to back you because the network would say no. And, cause he doesn't have the track record, but he totally established a look and a style that now everybody is emulating when they do that show. So here's a case where 18 episodes in, a man's life was changed because he had a true vision and a true artistic style. So you do get to really make a difference, but you do at the same time have to fit in and leave your mark. And for comedy, you know, did you come up with something funny that week? You know, did you add a little something? Did the cast have a good time? Did you get everybody out on time? For action, like what he did, you know, probably something stylized but still finished within a day and all that. But it's very tricky because it's also you're a lot of people want your job. It's a very interesting business. And the later a series goes, the trickier it can be to be a director on a show. You kind of want to get in. The sweet spot is into year one and the beginning. But all of year two is good. And the beginning of year three, pretty much after the midpoint of year three, it can get a little dicey too.
Okay.
It's very interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, no.
Because what, what happens is, you know, once the show's on, everybody wants an opportunity to direct. Anyway, one of the best ways to get a chance to direct is if a show's on the air for a few years. That's how I got to direct. I was on a sitcom, That's a Raven, that was on for a couple of years, and I was the first AD. And so you do get your opportunity. So you have to make the most of it. But, you know, then it becomes the opportunity that opening up. Everybody wants one. And for them, everybody's good. But listen, it's life, and there are people that don't have your best interest at hand because they have their own best interest at hand. You know, so it can become very interesting.
Right, right. So, yeah, and that I was going to say, so... Right, and your first credit was That's So Raven, and then you've done shows like Pair of Kings, Mighty Med,
I did the pilot to Mighty Med and the pilot to Kicking It, so I was able to establish the look for both of those shows. And then I've been doing a lot of adult stuff lately. I did some Undateables last year and the year before, the first season, and then I just did a Truth Be Told for NBC, which airs after Undateable, which is a really, really nice show and a great cast. And it was kind of cool because I used to watch Saved by the Bell and finally got to work with Mark Paul Gosselaar, who couldn't be more of a professional and nice guy. Like, just like that thing when you meet somebody and you've always seen them. And we never made any reference to Saved by the Bell, of course, but like, just I left there going, what a cool guy. Like, you know, like somebody you can hang out with, you know what I mean? Like, real stand-up guy, you know, very professional. And the funny thing is, you forget that he was on, he did some TNT shows, but you forget he was on NYPD Blue. Like, he's had a real 20-year career, mm-hmm. you know, since Saved by the Bell, of real acting, because he's really good. You know what I mean? He really cares. You know,
so, right. So that what I was going to ask, though, is you've done a lot of stuff on Disney and Nickelodeon. Do you like doing the family-friendly stuff? And
I do, but that's not what I watch. I watch the same things you guys watch. I just caught up on The Flash this morning. I adult stuff. And the funny thing was, my whole thing of the kid shows was, they always write it with a theme in mind. I would always Homeland, whatever the adult show version is, that's how I would try and shoot the kid show version. Like, if it was action scene and I saw something on Homeless and it was similar, Homeland, that's what I was trying to do. The Homeland version of the kid show, or whatever, whatever action thing it was, I was always trying to do the adult version of it, blended into that world, because that's my sensibility. But I, you know, I have to say, for anybody, and if you want to direct, or even in the comic book world, you have to find the road less traveled. And I got into kids programming because it was a road less traveled. Literally, that's where it was Disney's first sitcom, and nobody wanted to come there. You know, it was the first one. They didn't. There's a pay scale that everybody gets set up by the unions, and because it was their first one, they were paying 83% to 87% of the scale, so it wasn't even a full rate. But for me, it was just about the opportunity. You know, it's like, they kept getting canceled, and I wanted to direct, and I was like, I need to be somewhere where it's going to last. And so that was the perfect opportunity and the perfect place. So I can't say that I did. I traveled the road less traveled, which led me to the light. So that's what I would, you know, especially with the digital age now and different ways you can do things, like, find the road less traveled, because you need to be seen, because there's just so much, clutter out there. You know, it's just about getting seen.
Yeah. Right. So, all right. So then how did all of that experience translate into your graphic novel, or were they totally separate animals in your mind?
Totally separate animals in my mind, but now looking back, and I did not realize at the time, because I kept putting it out there in my mind, I kept coming back to it. One of my first jobs was on a show called Living Single, which was on Fox, mm-hmm. and the director at the time was married to the president of Marvel. So every Tuesday when they would come, he would come to the taping of the show, I would drill him about everything Marvel ad nauseum, to the point where they had bought a company called Malibu Comics, and invited me onto the company for a tour of how they make the comic books. And my buddy and I showed up in suits. And the first thing he said is, why are you all dressed up in suits? You know, I was like, well, you know, we're trying to represent. He's like, oh, yeah, well, the last people that came in here in suits was us, and we bought the place, so everybody's nervous. So they gave us a tour. And at the end of the tour, the editor asked me, did I want to write a Spider-Man Stop the Violence special? And I did. And I don't know if it was 3 weeks or 3 months later, Marvel went into bankruptcy, so I've never seen it.
Mm.
I know it's come out, but someone's told me it came out. But imagine, you get to write Spider-Man, which is are one of the greatest heroes of all time, even though it was just a little one thing special. But you wrote your own comic book, so the bug, it had taken over by then. That I had to do my own. You know, I had a taste of the good of what it's really like, and it just became a nighttime upset of 6 years. And I did that. It was one of the things that I did was the books were not going to come out till all three of them were done. I knew it was going to be a 3 book graphic novel series because I always hated that I would get. I used to love the Image books in the 90s, and then they would stop. And I never got to the end of it. You know, the story would just stop. And I would just always get mad for an ending. So I definitely had to have an ending. So that was the big thing. And also because I'd never written a novel before. So I decided to do it in the style that I direct a show, which is you shoot the show, and then you go into editing, and you may make some changes, and then, you know, finally come out with the thing. So when we did the books,
right.
He drew them by scene, not by page. We didn't number them till the end. And then... once we got it and we put the words on it, we went back in and made changes. If we had to, if the words didn't work, I rewrote it. If there were images missing, we would reformat the page and add pages. And so it was like we edited ourselves before the books actually came out, which helped a lot. And I think it totally worked.
Right, right. And again, you're doing this all through your own company, right? I mean, this is
I am.
Totally independent.
Yeah, which I did not know that there was a glass. All that research, all that stuff, and the two things I didn't know. We premiered at comic book at Comic Con, and after all that, first time it was time to sell the books, I didn't have a pitch. Like I didn't have a 2-sentence pitch on what the book was. So I made up one that weekend, which was hilarious. All that work, all those years, and never was like so that. And then the other thing is, I did not realize there was such a big glass ceiling on independence because at first we would always hear, "Oh, your book is good." For an independent, and we would just hear the book is good, but after a while, you start to really listen, and you hear for an independent. Oh, and so there really is a thick glass ceiling, independence that you.
So that's something I haven't heard before. I mean, is this like the same kind of glass ceiling with regular artists and creators, where like if you're in Marvel, you're either writing background characters or a couple of pages, whereas some guys are able to do the covers and stuff? Or is it like there's a couple of independents that everybody looks to and says, oh, they're the ones that made it, and you have to break into that? Or
no, I think the real thing of the independents, and different than the two companies, is that it's not the artists and the other people that look at it, because you guys are like, you saw the book and you guys wanted to talk to me, which was great, so you see the quality. It's the average fan turns their nose at independence. The fan that you get when you have a story with something new that's been around for 50, 60 years aren't initially open to it because they haven't heard of the name. There's no name behind it. And there's really two, you know, Marvel and DC are Americana. They're ingrained in our, even if you're not into comic books, you know, Disney owns Marvel. If you take your kid to a Disney store, one wall is Disney, one wall is Star Wars, one wall is Marvel. So even if you never bought your kid a comic book, he still might be wearing a Captain America t-shirt. So they're yeah. They are Americana. They that's why Steven Spielberg was wrong when he said, probably maybe one of the only things he's ever been wrong about, because I love Steven Spielberg. He's wrong when he said comic books will go away like the Westerns. They won't, because you're not buying your kid shirts of people of cowboys and Indians. But you're buying your kids shirts of Batman and Superman and Spider-Man. They're ingrained in our society. They're our Greek gods. They're Americana. And they will pass on from generation to generation. Now, will every movie make $1 billion? No, every movie won't make $1 billion. But will superheroes always be around? Absolutely. They'll never go away.
And one more another.
Right, right. They're I mean, you can't even really say modern anymore, but they're, you know, the modern myths, you know.
Yeah.
And yeah. Miss last generations and generations. But you know, the thing is, I think one of the other issues too, right? Like you're saying, they're ingrained in the Americana. Marvel and DC's been around for, you know, 75 plus years, at least DC, Marvel's 60 plus years. And it's, you know, you can just put out a new Spider-Man book and there's a guaranteed built-in audience. Independence. You know, you guys, the difference is you have to work for your audience a little bit more,
yep.
But you're doing something you love. You're creating your own character. I've talked to lots of people on this show, I have lots of friends who have worked for Marvel and DC, and a lot of them have all said the same things, like, oh yeah, it's great to work on Batman. I grew up reading Batman. I love Batman. But now that I'm doing my own creator-owned book, I have the freedom to do what I want and tell the story the way I want to tell it. Mm-hmm. You know, so independents are a lot more creative a lot of times, you know? And,
oh, absolutely. They are more creative, and they have more freedom. But it's a system that's set up in a weird way, even with the comic book shops, is weird because comic book shops have to pay the direct market, they have to pay up front. So mm-hmm. independents, they buy to sell. Spider-Man, you can buy 10 extra Spider-Mans because every 10 years, Sony's going to remake the same movie. So sure. Eventually, you could get rid of that book. So with an independent, though, unless it crosses over and becomes something like, because you have to pay up front, you could get stuck with. So the whole market from the direct market to how people see independence is just set up in a way that is very, it's a very thin, if they're going down a street, it's a very thin street, and it's a glass ceiling. So you just really have to break that, keep banging away to break that glass ceiling. Once you can do that, then you're good to go. But that's the thing I did not realize. I always thought, because I was always somebody that would go by the independents and, oh, this is cool, this is different, you know, as well as I would go by the Marvel or the DC booth. But, you know, you always go by what you think, but it's not always what everybody else thinks. And that's the one thing I've learned is it's just trying to break that glass ceiling.
Right, so. Right. Yeah, no, and it's the whole thing is Spider-Man had to start as an idea for somebody, and Superman had to start as an idea in somebody's head. They weren't huge successes just because Marvel did them. They became successes over time.
Yeah, but they came at the ground in the ground floor, like he was saying, is that they took the chance.
But I also kind of think, and it's, you know, I mean, of course, we're a podcast, so we're not following any rules of normal broadcasts. But it also comes back to us too, and I'm talking to all of my fellow podcasters and people in the media who listen to this show, like. It's the idea of treating a comic book differently because it's independent, or treating a movie differently because it's independent. It's still a creative outlook, and you have to take each thing on its own merits, regardless of it was produced by Marvel or produced by, you know, Eric by himself, you know, right. and that's the whole thing. And that's one of the reasons, like, cause somebody asked me this not too long ago, like, they said, oh, I really love your show because you have a good mix of guests on your show. And it's like, well, of course, I would never turn away an independent because I think, you know, if I had Neil Adams on here, he might draw a bigger audience, but that's fine. But I also want to give the voice to the guys who are doing it on their own because they're just as important of a voice.
Yeah, but right. we totally yep. have Neil on here. We would totally do that.
And you should.
But then even Neil had to start somewhere. Right. And all these guys had to start somewhere. And so, you know, if we find the next Todd McFarlane or whatever, then, you know, you have to keep giving people chances or else yeah. we're stuck with the same people and that glass ceiling turns into a one-way door.
Yep. Absolutely it does. Absolutely it does.
So.
Yep.
So for the listeners, why don't you give them the rundown on Legend of the Mantamanji?
Okay. Yeah, where'd you come up with the idea for the powers? That is really interesting.
It really was like a smorgasbord of just like ideas, and I did do a lot of research like on African history and things like that, and the weapon that I chose, the Ankh, is the Egyptian key of life. So I just felt like key of life, what kind of weapon, and you know, and then with all stories, you have to give it a weakness. So, you know, he can only make weapons that were around 3,000 years ago. So no guns and missiles of today, because that's where they started. But basically, for everybody listening, if they don't know, Legend of the Mantamanji is the story of a shallow, conceited district attorney of New York who finds out he's the last in a race called the Mantamanji that used to protect us from the forces of evil. So he's the last person you would ever want to be a hero, has to defend us against an evil sorcerer who's been resurrected in New York City. And is posing as a religious leader. So it's a world building story where you find out about the Mantamanji 3,000 years ago, and it all takes place in present day, and there's flashbacks and a lot of twists. Like each book ends with a huge twist. And it's a complete story. And this is the most unlikable guy. Like if you only read the first 30 pages, you won't like him because he really is a shallow, conceited guy. And it's his journey of, if he survives, you know, becoming a better person and stuff. And so the Mantamaji, they can create illusions, and they have an Ankh, which is Egyptian key of life. It looks like a cross with a loop, and it can become any weapon, you can think of, just, except it, that was around 3,000 years ago. So swords, whips, staffs, knives, no guns, no missiles, no bombs.
Yeah. So here's a question, cause you had already told me the short is the beginning of the book,
yep.
The first book. And I am just curious if this was a conscious decision, because I thought this was actually a really cool thing. And to me, it spoke about the character. The first thing that he creates actually isn't a weapon, it's a shield.
Yeah.
To defend himself first, mm-hmm. before he goes and attacks. Right. So was that a conscious decision or?
Yes. Yes, it was. Because when you read the whole stories, you find out that basically it starts out with him as the Mantamaji. And that the short is the actual opening scene of book one. That's how book one really starts. Mm-hmm. And I felt that here's a guy because he took on the thing for the wrong reason. His first thing is defense, and then it becomes offense after that. So his first thing is protect himself, because I thought the symbolism of that. So mm-hmm. The shield was definitely a purposeful choice. Just the fact that he runs and jumps into the middle of a room, I was like, you know, nobody would do that unless they don't know really know what the heck they're doing. So, you think about it, he literally runs down the side and he leaps into the middle of a room. Like, he just made himself a dead target. So, like, even that, like, even his movement, you know, it's hard because you only got like 6 minutes, so you can't get into the subliminal stuff of all that stuff. But yeah, that every choice was an actual choice, which reflects, you know, what's going on.
And, so here, now here's another question. And we talked about this a little bit in New York, this isn't meant as a loaded question or anything like that.
Oh, you can load it. I'm ready for it. Load it up.
No, but you're an not only are you an independent, but you're an African American, and you're telling the story of an African American character. And let's be honest, mm-hmm. the comic industry is not known for balance.
Not at all.
And only within recent years have we, you know, become more accepting of African American characters. Have you felt any kind of resistance or issue with that?
Here's the thing. Yes. But in saying that, I don't know that it's race-based versus lack of seeing a lot of heroes of color that have lasted continuously for a long time, mm-hmm. to know that they, to open up to this one. Because, I believe Black Panther will open huge, and it's a Marvel movie. So, some people don't like Marvel movies. I think their movies are great because it's a movie. So I think it'll be a great movie.
I like them too. For
what do you say?
Not the DC guys. So.
Oh, okay. I think they'll do. Well, then in 2020, when you guys do Cyborg, I'm sure that will be good too. But I have to be honest. Like, this is how I look at it. And I mean this in the nicest possible way. I'm going to be probably one of the first people to see Black Panther. But in honesty, that'll be the 18th movie that they made. So it was more important to do the Rocket Raccoon and a man talking to ants and a talking tree, as cute as it was, than to do a movie about a hero from the biggest continent with the most people in the world. So there's something said to that. That said, I look forward to the movie, but I also go, that character is 40 or 50 years old, as is Power Man when it comes on Netflix next year. We don't have anything that's long term that's running. You know, there's no character from the last 10 years, 20 years, 30 years that kind of really resonates. So, you know, kind of like a victim of the system. And I don't think the system is fair, and I don't think the system is right, but it is the system. Like, there just hasn't been staying power of those heroes. I think a lot of them are coming back now because they're going to be TV shows and movies. I don't know that they were rushing to bring them back if they weren't going to be something else. Which is sad because they are great characters, but just like in the movie, they were just never top 10 characters. So right. I always try to like make sure I'm saying this right, because I don't want to make anybody think I'm insulting these characters, because Cyborg was my favorite character and Teen Titans was my favorite book growing up. Mm-hmm. And I loved Black Panther. So I'm not insulting either one of them in a way, but I am pointing out the fact that there's a problem, and it's been going on for a long time, and I don't think that the problem is necessarily over, although we are making strides. One movie does not make a trend. One is not a trend. You know,
right.
It all just started with Blade, this modern age of superhero stuff. At least in the Marvel world, started with Blade, and then 18 movies later, you know, we get another one. So one is not a trend, you know what I mean? I think we have a long way to go, and it does make it hard that he's African American. What makes it hard, though, is that people assume that it's just a black book, if you can use that term, and he's just fighting to save drugs out of the neighborhood. No, he's trying to save the world, and it's a multicultural book. Yes, he's black, but there's no reference to him being black, because my thing is this. I grew up loving Indiana Jones and loving James Bond, and they always saved the world. I never saw a woman or any person of color saving the world. So I wanted to save the world, because my thing is, if you see people of color and women and minorities, whoever, saving the world, and that becomes the norm, then it opens it up, and then you start having more stuff like that, you know? So the only part that I get upset is if someone thinks it's just, oh, it's just a black superhero and it's only a black thing. It's like, no, he's in New York, and New York is multicultural, and he's saving the world just like everybody else did, like Iron Man did, like whoever else did. And you'll find a lot of other characters that relate to you if you're a woman or a man or African American or Indian or Asian and all that. So I always want people to look to go beyond that, and then I look at that. That's my thing. That's where I get a little want to push the envelope or get a little huffed up about. But it's definitely harder.
Basically, you're not making a big deal because it shouldn't be a big deal, and it shouldn't even matter, and it shouldn't be something somebody even thinks about that. Oh, his skin color is different. It should just be, hey, hero.
Right, right. But in seeing his skin color, if that subliminal message gets to you, and the next time you see a hero of the same color or close to the same color, and you go, oh, that's cool, then it is doing its job. It is opening up the world. I think you can have a social message without alienating people and hitting them over the head.
No, and that's so true. And it's so funny because we actually had this conversation, I want to say maybe 6 months ago, with another creator, and we were talking about not African-American, but homosexual characters. And it's getting better now, but there was a time where it was like they would introduce a gay character and everything about that character was him being gay. And it's just two of my best friends are gay, and they're just regular guys that I don't, you know, they don't talk about gay things all the time. They don't sit there and, you know, because it's, you know, it's using stereotypes to try to use a character and make it acceptable, but it doesn't work that way. They're just regular people.
They're marketing them.
Oh, absolutely.
It's marketing. That's all it is.
Absolutely. I mean, look, even though Power Man was created in the 70s in black exploitation, if you always remember, he was always doing stuff for money. Like every other superhero was doing it he was doing it just for money. I'm not gonna take that on this one. So they were definitely like, he's black, we gotta throw some black thing in there to make him feel black, which kind of took away from it. You know what I mean? Like,
right,
he's
right.
Power Man, but he's doing this stuff for money. And then of course they had the horrible slang, Sweet Christmas and all that other stuff, but we can look beyond that because maybe that's part of the time. But he was, you know, here's the, fine, we got a black hero, but he's only doing stuff to get paid. You know what I mean? Like, there's a lot of, you know, you're right about that. Like, the gay characters and always having to say they're gay and all that. Like, that's that alienates people. That doesn't help.
Right, right. No, exactly. Because one of our first episodes, one of the first times we covered a convention was at the East Ekbok, East Coast Black Age of Comic Book Creators. Yeah. And and I met Tony Isabella there. And he was talking about when he worked at Marvel, and he's like, oh, you know, we have to give African Americans a voice. And they were like, oh, well, we have Luke Cage. And he's like, yeah, but he's an ex-con. He's doing it for money, blah, blah, blah. And that's one of the reasons he actually left Marvel, went over to DC and created Black Lightning, because he was trying to create a character who didn't have all these black marks on his record, like just an ordinary guy who wanted to be a superhero who happened to be African American, you know. And
the one I want to see is Static Shock, for crying out loud. I mean, the backstory in that one is really, it's a story of hope, and of pain, but it's not, it's like you're getting at, it's a normal hero story. It has nothing to do with the skin color or anything, and his characterization is incredibly good.
Right.
Soon.
Yep. Yep. Hopefully they're going to do it. Hopefully they'll they're working on it, I think. So hopefully they'll come out with it. So,
but
the more the merrier, because I like I said, one is not a trend. It's and the funny thing about this is when one does good, it opens up the door for others.
Right.
So I will. There's only other one other time, and I've said this in recently. I was talking to somebody that I will. The only thing that'll make me sad is if when they do have these My Hero or Static Shock or Power Man, whatever, if they start to go in sentences in the press or they write, well, they have all these heroes, so now they have to have a black one. You know, it's like no, you don't have to have a black one. You just have to have a hero, and he just happens to be of this color because you did not have it before. When it gets to that point, then I will be sad because that means that you know, people are missing the point. But a lot of people do. Like, this is still a niche market, the stuff that we love and watch and do. It's still a niche market.
Right. Mm-hmm. Well, and one of the things, too, is when they're going to do a character and they race change a character. And it's just like, well, okay, I understand you're trying to bring diversity to this movie, but why not just pick one of the many African-American characters that already exist and give them a movie, you know?
Yeah, that's a slippery slope. My answer has always been the same on that, is that I'm okay with it, but it points out the fact that you couldn't pull from your 4,000 characters because you did not develop any minority characters. So,
right.
You know, and you have to realize these are companies doing this to reinvigorate things that are stale. So it's still the same thing. At the end of the day, they can always switch them back. you know what I mean? It's not like you go pull from your, had they been developing, you know, multicultural characters throughout all these years, then you could pull from it, you know. I do like what they did on Flash, making Iris and her father black. That's different. They weren't really – I don't think she wasn't a superhero, right? She was always just
– right.
Yeah.
I think that's fine. I think that's great. It makes that show that much better.
But there's rumors that Wally West is going to be black too. Wally West is actually her long-lost brother.
He is.
Yep. Obviously, Wally would have to be black if Iris is black.
Yes, right. I know.
Yeah. Yeah. Let's be logical, people.
Right. Yeah. No, they are doing that. I don't know if you saw last night's episode, but they mentioned that there was a brother. So, yeah,
yes.
It's coming. That's coming.
No, and that's fine. I mean, I don't have an issue with that. In fact, I will actually, it's funny, as bad as the Fantastic Four movie was, the only defense I have for that movie for Fox was when race changing Johnny Storm, because they didn't have any other characters to pick from, and they're trying to do a superhero franchise.
Right.
You know, so
where they failed in two fronts on that. Mm-hmm. They failed, because I saw the movie. They failed.
Oh, you poor thing. Who threatened your kids?
I know, right? They failed in a relationship, the brother and sister relationship, which would make you care. And they failed in the interviews leading up to the movie. I thought Michael B. and I forgot the girl's name did a great job. But Fox should have been more aggressive, and they should have been able to be more aggressive for people that would act stupid and ask them stupid questions.
Right.
You know, because the thing is, you can control that. I mean, you know, you can paint the people, you can flip that back on people and make them feel idiots for doing it. And you can also control how things are talked about in the press. And I thought they failed. I thought Fox failed the actors on that point. And I thought that the story failed the characters, and Fox failed the actors. That's what I felt with that.
You know? No, I agree with that, because I saw some interviews where and a couple times they were asked about, well, how can you be brother and sister if you're not the same? And it was just like, hello, this is 2015.
Yeah.
You know, the idea of a traditional family has changed many times over. Like, of course there's adoption, you know, or half brother, half sister, whatever the story is, you know, like it's very possible.
Absolutely. And I thought it could have addressed it more in the movie. And I thought they could have had a better bond. Like, there was no real connection between the
right.
two.
Right.
Yeah.
Being brother and sister, you know? So that's where I think it,
Well, that was, yeah, I mean, that was the biggest criticism of all about the movie, is that, you know, they're Marvel's first family, but they didn't feel like a family at all in the movie.
Not at all. I think they, I've always said this, and Kevin Feige said it, because he's, you know, bigger than I am. He said, no matter how silly the origin story is, find a way to tell it. And the fact that they have yet to tell the Fantastic Four the right way is baffling to me. When you consider Iron Man, they cast a great actor and got a great director, but let's face it, he was in a cave and they asked him to build a bomb and he built a suit. They never could tell the difference between a bomb and a suit. But it worked because they committed to that wholeheartedly in the movie. And that's all you have to do with these superhero movies, you know. That's why the sequels to the superhero movies are so much harder than the first ones, because you're going away. You really are creating an original story with the sequel, where in the original origin movie, you can tell the story, like, you know, but they made it work. And that, to their credit, that launched the Marvel Age of movies. And why Fox can't figure that out, and why they would make a Fantastic Four movie that never told the origin, that makes it baffling.
Well, so. I have to disagree with you. They did make a Fantastic Four movie that told the origin story right. It's just that Roger Corman did it, and they never released it. That movie is literally better than the last two big budget ones. I can't get over that.
Although Dr. Doom's mask, I don't think that holds up.
No, that didn't hold up. But they acted properly. I mean, they acted to their comic book characterizations, and the storyline was actually really good, and they actually did stuff. And
right,
you know,
right. That's hilarious. Yep.
So, so since you have, you know, you do have a connection with the Disney and you're a director, would you ever want to direct an episode of Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D.?
I'd love to. It's a long process. Hopefully the short will help me get onto that road. But basically, in Hollywood, works like this. Whatever, and it is a watching actually said.
Uh-oh.
They're hard to get in, so you have to pick whatever road you can get in at. I got in doing programming, and then it took a while, and now I'm going to do adult programming. And the short's going to help open up some roles where I get to do some more action-y adult programming, and then on and on and on. So, I would love to do S.H.I.E.L.D., Arrow, Flash, especially Arrow, because that's the only show I watch in real time. I would love to do all that stuff, but it's a process. So, yeah, I got the short now, and then I have to, you know, hopefully get some meetings and hopefully show some other stuff, maybe shoot some other we actually want to make more shorts, show some of the other characters, and then do some more stuff with him.
Good, because I'm lazy.
I was actually thinking about doing a, you know, that one was done with friends and favors, so now I kind of have to find money, so we might do a crowdfunding at the beginning of January. We're trying to put the together now where we do about six or seven different shorts of different characters. Some will be scenes from the book, some will be scenes that either were prequels, like Mariah, the mom, basically in the story, the Mantamaji, one of them went bad, Sirach, 3,000 years ago, and they got into this big battle, and pretty much all the Mantamaji were wiped out, and the last leader, Kandor, took his pregnant wife and put her in a suspended animation to wake up in present day if Sirach or any Mantamaji ever return. So the mother, Mariah, goes to sleep for 3,000 years, wakes up with what becomes Elijah, her son. And so when you see them now, he's grown, he's a shallow DA, and she's a older woman. But I would love to do like a little short showing her fighting pregnant and just, you know, waking up in Africa and then making her way to the U.S. and, you know, moving around and not knowing 3,000 years later, not knowing what happened and not knowing where they are and all that type of stuff. So we're putting together hopefully a little plan to do six or eight little shorts that are all different tones, different stories. Like I said, some will be scenes from the book and some will be like those prequels and things I talked about and some of the other characters' backstories that they verbally talked about, but you did not see. So hopefully I get to do that. Then that'll give me a nice, you know, a whole lot of footage to show for shows like S.H.I.E.L.D. and other stuff like that. As well as build the brand. You know what I mean? Like build the brand. Because with three books, we have so much backstory. Anybody that reads them, you'll see there's so much story and so many things you could do and so many things we were able to do. We basically created a world that there's, you know, there's a lot to do. And we're actually working on two more books right now. So continuing the story of all the characters that survive.
Cool. What do you think was the biggest challenge in writing this story and getting it done?
Oh, book one, the origin. Because there's two ways to do an origin. And if you're telling the Batman story, you can wait 45 minutes to see him in Batman or Spider-Man. If they don't know what your character is, you need to show them something right away. You need to, you know, you either start off like Raiders of the Lost Ark, or you start off like, you know, Batman Begins or Spider-Man. You know what I mean? You either take your time to do it. And I believe, and for the longest time, I wanted to start off like Spider-Man. And it wasn't until finally the last year when we were working on book three that you put your ego aside and you go, nobody knows what this is. give him something right away. And that's why he starts off like, that's why the short is the first scene in book one. And it actually works because it shows you how different the books are to start off that, you know, guns blazing like that. And that, that was the hardest part. So we were even working on book three and I was still moving scenes around in book one. It's pilot. You know, if for anybody that doesn't get that, doesn't write a book, but watches TV, think of a pilot, how hard pilots are. Because when you think about the dialogue in a pilot, how every, when people are talking, they're always saying what their job is or where they're from. They're never talking like we are having a normal conversation. They're always like, well, you know, when my wife left me, I just felt like I just should take this job on. You know what I mean? Like, what?
Because they have to tell you. Would write it that way, but.
Yeah, yeah. So, yeah.
That is so true. That is so true. And it's so funny. Like, I never thought about it until you just said it, but that's like with Indiana Jones. If it hadn't opened with that scene in the jungle, you would have lost interest if it started with him in a university talking about being an archaeology professor, you know?
Oh, yeah. Oh, totally. Yeah, I mean, literally, you saw him in the scene in the jungle, then you go, wait, he's a professor? Like, a professor? Is that, like that, is that action guy? Like, to, you know, everything about that movie worked and how they did it. And it's a great example of how to start off. Even in The Matrix, when they start off with Trinity and she breaks the laws of gravity with the kick, it's something different. You know what I mean? Like, wait, what is this? You know, then you could take your time with Neo and Sean, but they basically, in that opening scene, you know, her leaping and all that showed you stuff that he ends up doing. So you still saw it, you know?
Do you think that goes for novelizations too? I mean, I can understand for movies because you have a really limited amount of time. And if you've got a new character, you really do have to grab people's imaginations really quickly. And same thing with, I guess, comic books, because you're putting out basically a very small amount every month and you want them to buy the next month after the first month. So you have to grab them then. You don't want to take like 5 months to tell the backstory. What about novels? What do you think of that?
I agree. I think so. I think it helps now because all this media is cross-pollinated and so saturated. I do think you should start off with something. And the last few novels I read, they have. I haven't had time to read a lot of novels, but I just think it's better to always start with something, and then we can all find out later on what it is, because you just get us, you get us involved right away. You know, and I just think that for the passive fan or the aggressive fan, I think it just it works.
Yeah, John, not to step on Eric's toes, you and I are both big fans of the Dresden Files. Think about how the first book starts out. You know, he comes into a scene, you know, that of where the police hired him, and it's a kind of a morbid scene, and sets the tone for the books right away. You know, I think that's where the opposite, you know, what you had just said with, like Spider-Man or Batman or whatever, you know what you're in for. A great example is when they relaunched back in 2000 with the Ultimate series. They first started with Ultimate Spider-Man, and he doesn't actually become Spider-Man until like issue 3, you know. But when Bendis wrote it, he knew that. He knew the payoff. Everyone knew the payoff who went into it. He's going to become Spider-Man. So he really elongated the origin story, but I don't really care for the first couple of issues because it's like I want to get to the action right away.
But what you're saying is when you have a big name like that, you can trade on the anticipation.
Right. Of, right.
Okay. So how is the spider gonna bite him this time? And that sort of thing. And people are actually waiting to see other things other than I wonder what his first punch in the face is gonna look like.
Yep. Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah, yeah. I just think it helps. But I gotta be honest, I can't say that it took me, you know, years. I fought it and fought it and fought it and fought it for a long time and finally said, you know, put your ego aside. What's best for the series? What, you know, what are people gonna respond to? And then that's how I came up to that decision.
Right.
And
that's always true, I think, in any art, is you have to put your ego aside and what serves the story best, what serves the art best.
Yeah, and now having done it, I swear by it, and that's the only way I'll ever do it. So going from one spectrum to the other.
So you said you wanted to do a couple more shorts.
Yeah.
And then you have a couple more issues in the works. But for those who want the graphic novel now or the first three issues, What's the best way they can get a
hold of this? They should go to Amazon or Barnes & Noble or our website, which is Legend of the Mantamaja, which I will spell because it's very hard. MANTAMAJI.com. Actually, if you just go to the website, it has the short. It has all the links of every way you can get it. You can get it digitally or print. Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Kobe, Comicology. So there's every which way. We have all three books. And then I'm sure we're with the holidays coming. If you buy it from us on our website, I'm signing each copy. So we'll definitely have some holiday give-backs.
Oh, nice.
All that. So that'll be cool.
Even have a Kindle edition.
Pardon me?
Even have a Kindle edition. I'm looking at it right now.
Yeah. Yeah, it's available in every format. And then a friend of mine wants to translate it into Spanish and some other languages. So I definitely want to take him up on that too. So, I mean, I really got into this to build a world. That's why the books are so big. Each book's like 200 pages and there's so many characters and so much stuff. And that's the thing we're doing with the next two books. I really did want to build a world. Like, I love, you know, watching shows or reading books with all these characters and things that have been around for 40 and 50 years that you love. So I really, there really was a passion to, you know, not, hey, I'm create this to take it, make it to a TV show or a movie. It really was to build this, like, this empire, this series, you know, and this universe. And then would I love it to be other things? Absolutely. But the first and foremost, I wanted to create my own universe.
Cool.
Yeah. You've got some nice reviews here on Amazon too. People seem to really like it.
Oh yeah. 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 No, we've been blessed. People really like it. They are responding to it and they like the short. And I have to say, this is funny because when people watch the short, you can, you know, it's interesting to read all the comments and some people that, you know, critique it, and they, you know, like filmmakers, and then others that are just like, it has potential. And I'm like, well, you should check out the books. You know, it's like, you know, like they think it just came out of nowhere. But yeah, so it's kind of cool.
Yeah, that must be the hardest thing, to put out something and then see the Amazon comments start to come in and wondering, do I want to read them? Yeah. Do I want to put myself through them?
I know you always do. Listen, for me, I always read them. I always do. And after a while, you kind of get a perspective. But we've been lucky, like most. Everybody we got 4 or 5 stars. It's oddly enough, people like book two better than book one, because like I said, it's hard to do that origin story. But by book two is just, you know, wall to wall action and story, and we just jump in. So yeah, we got all great five reviews on book two, 5 stars. Yeah.
But I think the best criticism of all is your son thinking he's a real character.
I know.
Or
I know.
As important of a character as Superman.
Yes, yes, yes. Well, yes. Now, mine doesn't have a cape, so he has to be Superman, because, of course, Superman has a cape. But he does want other people to be Mantamaji. So, yes, yes. Which I'm okay with. I'm okay. He has his Superman cape on every other day, and I'm okay with it. I actually help him put it on.
So, all good. Just tell him Mantamaji is so badass, he doesn't need a cape.
I will say exactly that.
Oh, man. Well, you know what? That's actually, I don't know if you've listened to the show before, but that's a good way to lead into our sign off.
Oh, yeah. Cool. But before we do, go through the, go through where we can find you, where people can find you.
Oh, yes.
And you can follow me on Twitter, which is my name, Eric Dean, D-A-N Seaton, S-E-A-T-O-N. You can go to the Legend of Mantamaji Facebook page. Or just go to legendsofmantamaji.com, which has the link to everything. Again, Mantamaji is MANTAMAJI.com. And then you can get the book on Amazon, Kindle, Kobe. I'm available on every social medium there is, including Instagram. And it's all my name or Legend of Mantamaji. One of those, you remember those two names, you'll be able to find pretty much the entire universe.
Yes.
And you,
yes.
Are you doing a Patreon or a Kickstarter or anything like that?
We will be doing a Kickstarter, I think in the first week in January or so. I don't know that we should do it during the holiday, because people got to buy their gifts and for friends and family. Yeah. So I think we will, and also give me some more time to get exactly organized on what we're going to do. But we're definitely going to do a Kickstarter to do more shorts. What I really want to do is a series of shorts, and you can maybe get an app or something where you could get the books and the shorts all for one price. Together. Yeah. Which is cool. And we're going to offer some different things with our Kickstarter, besides your producer credit, something that hasn't been done, I can't say yet, on Kickstarter, which could be very interesting. Could be very interesting.
Well, now that John has ruined my comic timing,
Oh, but that's what you pay me for. That's right, you don't pay me. Never mind.
So as we say each and every week, boys and girls,
oh, the cape.
Don't let your cape get caught in the door. Have a good week. Right.
Okay, now it's my turn. Okay, what are you doing? Taking over Dad's mic so I can be part of superhero speak. Duh.
Well, there are better ways to join the conversation.
Really? Like what?
Well, you can interact with them on Facebook, Twitter, Google+, and even Pinterest.
Wait, people use Pinterest? And what's Google+?
I don't know, something to do with circles. Anyway, you can also see all their posts, including comic book videos, on their website, where you can also sign up for their mailing list.
Cool!
Yep, are you still going to try to hijack Dad's mic?
Nope, I'm going to try to answer the Stump the Geek question.
Nice. So who do you think would win in a fight between Rainbow Dash and Squirrel Girl?
Oh, that's a hard one. Oh no, Dad's waking up. Run for your lives!
Oh, what are you guys doing? That cape's going to get caught in the door.
Ow.